Hey, everybody, Patrick Connor here, and welcome back to Knuckles and Gloves Boxing Radio. I'm here with my buddy Aris Pina, and man, we got some stuff to talk about, like Canelo Plant and the slap heard, the two-piece slap heard around the world, and we're previewing Anthony Joshua versus Alexander Usyk today. Dude, how's it going, man?
It's going good, man. A lot to talk about today in the boxing world. A lot of entertaining shit happened today.
Man, it's
you know, I woke up today just thinking it was just going to be another day in the neighborhood, whatever. I didn't even know there was a press conference scheduled today between Canelo and Plant. And yeah, the bad blood boiled over finally. I didn't even know what was going on. I was at work and I just happened to check Twitter really quick to see what was popping. And people were talking about Plant getting, you know, owned or something. I was like, the hell are they talking about? Looked it up and there you go.
I knew that there was a press conference only like this morning and I was like, all right, that's pretty cool. But, you know, I wasn't even really tuning into it. I was just kind of looking at the updates of what people were saying on Twitter. And then next thing I knew, people were posting video of like grainy video of what happened. And I'm thinking, oh shit, what's going on? Saying Plant's cut. He's cut. Oh shit. My first thought was they're gonna call off the fight if he's cut. This is bad.
I mean, but even though it's under the eye, that's still a gnarly cut.
Yeah, it wasn't a super great cut. It was not a friendly cut. So I wouldn't be shocked if they did, but hopefully there's enough time between now and when the fight goes down. But man,
when's it scheduled for?
It's November.
Okay, we gotta hope. Yeah, I think that's
20th or something like that.
It's like 2 months from now, so
yeah. Something like that. It's over a month away, so hopefully it'll be okay. But regardless, it's
probably his shades, I think, to be honest.
It's what
I said, it was probably his sunglasses that he's wearing that probably caused
that's what it looked like. Yeah, because it didn't even at first it looked like Canelo hit him with a left hook. So pretty much what happened was, from what I gather, kind of Sherlock Holmesing this shit in hindsight, what happened was they're going up to their little stare down face off thing. They're jawing at each other. Mm-hmm. And whatever it was that Caleb Plant said, I guess Canelo didn't like it, or I'm not entirely sure what happened, but Canelo pushed him. Caleb Plant came back and looked like he was going to slap him with his left hand. And Canelo kind of took the mustard off it, just barely got touched by the slap. And slapped him back twice, except for one of the slaps like broke Caleb Plant's glasses, I think, and actually cut him. Yeah, under the eye, just boom. I actually have a cut in the exact same spot, but not from glasses. And anyway, yeah. So a lot of fun, and that's what literally everybody's talking about. It seems like
at least they were smart on their end for using open hand slaps instead of trying to punch the shit out of
you. That's true.
You know, and actually injuring themselves in the process of doing something.
Yeah, breaking a hand. That would be
Plant's lucky he didn't catch the Archie Solis.
Yeah, man. Archie Solis, he could tell him what's up. He could tell him what Canelo's power's like.
You know, like Canelo don't play no bullshit, man. He'll come out there to swing on you if he has to. And he did. I think it was because he said, like, I think he interpreted something that Plant said as an insult to his mom.
That's well, he was saying it sounded, somebody was saying motherfucker, motherfucker. I don't know what
he took that as his mom, I guess.
Well, in Spanish, if you were to literally translate motherfucker, it would probably be chinga tu madre or something like that, something similar. It's not just like an errant thing you say, like in English.
It's not just like commonplace how I say it every day.
Yeah, like, oh, this motherfucker, you know, you could say something like that. And that's not, unless you're friends with somebody, that's not really how it goes. And so anyway, I could see that happening for sure. Was it okay? No. I mean, I don't condone necessarily any sort of pre-fight anything, especially if they're not getting paid for it. That seems kind of foolish to have a fight.
I've seen Canelo get feisty before at press conferences. Remember he got in Triple G's face and put his finger up in there and, you know, tried to shove him a little bit or whatever. But like, this was the first time where he openly just was like, showed disdain and shoved the dude across the room.
It's
a lot. It's been, you know, Plant's been running off at the mouth a lot.
Yeah.
And
well, I think that there are some things that you can say about Canelo. Like there are some things that are in bounds and they make sense or whatever. I understand the perspective, for instance, like he's been mostly looked after pretty closely for most of his career, which is true. He has. Most of his fights have been televised. And when most of a fighter's fights have been televised, they're already in the kind of like upper few percent of fighters, period. But also with him being a redheaded, white-skinned dude from Mexico, already in and of itself kind of like an extra commodity. I mean, just laying it out plain. So he has kind of been taken care of in his career in a manner of speaking, but you also can't really go down his ledger and be like, that's shit. There are a number of fighters that he fought at times where people said there's no way in hell he'd fight him, or there's no way in hell he should fight them. Austin Trout shouldn't have really fought him at that time. You know, bad style for him, and it showed in the ring. Arislandi Lara could have avoided that, I suppose. Bad style for him, but he didn't. And that's just the kind of fighter that he's proven to be. But, I mean, it sounds like what Caleb Plant's seizing on is not even necessarily that, but the fact that he tested positive for clenbuterol before the Triple G rematch, which wound up postponing it.
And that's what he's been pushing on, calling him a cheater and all this other stuff.
And then on top of that, with Oscar Valdez testing positive in the Eddie Reynoso camp, then it's kind of like people start making those connections. And I'm not going to discourage anybody from doing anything. I mean, it's just a fact. Two fighters who were in that camp tested positive, and another fighter from that camp, Andy Ruiz Jr., is looking very different physically. I understand people asking these questions. I'm not saying that they're valid, just saying I understand it. But at the same time, flipping it back, Caleb Plant, I don't know if he still has any association with Snack, but he did. He was a Snack-sponsored fighter. And anybody who's like, Snack, SNAC, which is Victor Conti's quote-unquote nutrition supplement company. I can't even say it with a fucking straight face, man. Come on. It was Victor Conti's nutrition company, and he sponsors a whole bunch of boxing people and personalities, and Caleb Plant was among those people. It's like, so it's definitely a pot calling the kettle black situation, in my opinion. And so I'm not sure if that's where the anger stemmed from, is the accusation
that
he's
help. I know that definitely was pushing it, because Canelo is the one of those guys who's very proud of his career and where he comes from. And it's one thing, I guess, in his mind to say some shit, but it's a whole other thing when you start saying, you know, you're a cheater and you're not clean and trying to tarnish his reputation of what he's built so far in the sport. You know what I mean? Of being, you know, pound for pound, maybe the best in the world, or 1A, 1B, whatever you want to rate him as. But for Plant to be saying all these type of things, and for this fight to taking this long to come together too, I think he's frustrated by how long it took negotiations, the back and forth, the blame game of who, you know, why it didn't happen, all that stuff. And everything just kind of comes to the head, you know what I mean? And
I would agree. And I think that if you have to kind of look at it from his perspective too, he's the B-side, and rightly so. I mean, I'm not, let's not try to argue it like he's not.
He's not even headlined like a major show on, whether it be Showtime or, you know, he's been on Fox and headline Fox shows and stuff like that, but there's nothing compared to the level of what Alvarez
is. Right. And he's a fairly new title holder. He hasn't really accomplished that much as far as fighters go. That doesn't mean he can't win, but he's the B-side for a reason. But from his perspective, from the perspective of somebody who believes in themselves, from the perspective of any top level athlete who's going to believe they can win or will win, I get it. You know, he's pissed because he feels he's being slighted. He's pissed because he pretty much didn't really have much of a say in whatever goes into the negotiation, I would imagine. Mm-hmm. And that's probably an exaggeration. I'm sure he had some say, because he does have pull with the title, because I personally underestimated. I thought that Canelo was, you know, he's talked about unification, but I figured he'd probably just go in some other direction, but he didn't. He decided to unify.
Finish up the belts.
So you have to give them both some credit for that. But I mean, yeah, from Caleb Plant's perspective, I get that frustration too. But I mean, they're lucky that there was no no injury more serious that came from this, I guess. It's just,
I mean, I just put up a tweet, you know, from the Riddick Bowe Larry Donald press conference. I was like, if you want to throw a real punch at a press conference, this is how you do it. And it's like, you know, there's been some vicious ones. Like, this one was fun because it hasn't happened in a long time. And it's been a minute. And for it to escalate like that for such a big event, usually guys, they'll shove each other, they'll get each other's face, everyone jumps in before something really happens, right? The last time I can really remember, and I'm probably missing one, but the one I can really remember since then that someone got, like, duped in the mouth like that was probably, like, Vargas Mayorga.
Yeah, that's not a bad one. I mean, Ricardo Mayorga was basically getting under everybody's skin, like, for good reason.
Yeah.
He was definitely, that was his aim too.
You know what's funny?
Go ahead.
There's been a bunch of them. I'll tell you a funny story was that when the first press conference I ever attended was Vargas Mayorga. Not the one that where he got punched and everything went fucking crazy, but the second one that took place in New York. And I was at Showtime at the time, fresh out of college as a production assistant. So this was the first time I get to be a press conference, first time I see Don King in the flesh, and, you know, other personalities and all that, and I'm just kind of taking it all in, right? All of a sudden, Vargas first shows up. He gets in there with his entourage, gets, you know, near the dais. They had a divider between them, but before it could happen, Mayorga comes in now. And before Mayorga even gets to the stage, he's standing kind of near me and a group of other people, and he's yelling all kinds of, you know, nonsense at Vargas, you know, about threatening him, raising his fist, just being Mayorga. Vargas decides to jump off the dais and charge at Mayorga right there, and I'm still near. All of a sudden, I'm a tiny dude to begin with. I feel myself go flying out of the way, and it was the security guard shoving me away so we can get between them and make sure they don't kill each other. And this is the first press conference I've ever been to, and I was like, oh, yeah, this is awesome. Like, you know.
So what you're saying is that you're about to sue Ricardo Mayorga for that back pain.
Nah, I was fine with it. I thought it was cool as hell when I got flung. I was like, man, I actually got a part of this. I wonder if anyone got it on video.
That's good, because I don't think Ricardo Mayorga is going to be able to sustain.
Nah, no. Probably
not, but it's a little bit washed, unfortunately.
Yeah, there's been, like, the big fights. Like I said, mentioned Bo Donnell. Marco Antonio Barrera had a tendency to swing on guys back in the late 90s and early 2000s, which he did with the famous one with Eric Morales. And also with Kennedy McKinney.
Yeah, I was going to say he did with Kennedy McKinney. And I think there was one other fighter where he swung on him, pushed him or something. I can't remember who it was. But yeah, he was a bit hot-headed when it came to press conferences, for sure.
The McKinney one was funny because, like, you can clearly tell he has no idea what McKinney's telling him. Like, McKinney's running his mouth out, he's going to beat him and all that. And then Barrera looks back. He, like, looks at one of his quartermen like, what? And he just kind of goes, obvious swings at him.
Yeah, somebody earlier today was calling what Caleb Plant was trying to throw a sucker punch. Other people were calling Canelo, you know, the push kind of like a sucker punch move. I mean, I guess, but you want to see some real sucker punches too. Look at Bo hit Larry Donald with that two-piece sucker punch. I mean, kind of, since they were standing face to face, but he wasn't ready for it. But
yeah, Donald wasn't ready for it.
No, he was not expecting that at all. But Marco Antonio Barrera was definitely sucker punching like a motherfucker.
Yes,
for sure.
Yeah. And his punches didn't land as clean as Bo's did. I don't know how Donald's
first
off stood up to that, because most humans would drop from, you know, if not get cleanly knocked out, would definitely get, like, knocked on their ass from that shot. Because that was a two-piece that Bo threw with some oomph. That wasn't like a little, you know, nothing like.
Yeah, he was mad.
Hit him with a hook, and then he actually, like, bent down and, like, swung and cracked him with a right hand. So, one, Donald didn't get dropped, and that's astounding. And two, somehow he didn't get his mouth all lacerated, let him knock the tooth out, something that would have, like, you know, jaw broken.
Yeah, he was totally fine.
Yeah. The only thing that it did, I guess, was mess with his psyche, because, you know, when they ended up fighting, he didn't really put up much of a fight that Bo just waltzed through. But yeah, that's the gold standard.
Yeah, there have been some pretty good press conference, you know, skirmishes and stuff like that over the years. But man, you have to know that we're so starved and in such bad shape.
Yeah.
We are so ragged.
Hyped up for a smack fight.
Oh my dude, everybody, the entire timeline, my entire social media timeline was talking about this shit, because we're so just emaciated and thirsty for some shit.
it's pathetic. You know what though? I mean, it doesn't. I wonder how Plant felt though. Canelo did get a two-piece on him really quick, and even how he leaned back, like that was almost showing him right there. Like, what do you think you're trying on me, bro? You can't gonna steal on me.
And that's kind of like what I mean. I tweeted it earlier because I'm not trying to be like, I'm not making any excuses, but, and then offer an excuse. But like, you know, I'm not trying to say that it's anything more than it was. It was just a little press conference slappity thing. It wasn't the fight. The fight will, I'm certain, be different. But even so, like, it doesn't look real great. Because you would think that somebody who is way faster or supposed to be the counter puncher or
yeah,
the style on his ass
is going to give him, yeah, give him fits.
Yeah, he's about to style on him. And Canelo gave him the pull counter with the two piece and he wound up cut from it, whatever the cut was from, glasses, a hand, a ring, whatever. I mean, the point is Caleb Plant was walking away from that exchange bleeding, whatever the reason was. So, I mean, anyway, I know it's not the fight. But it's kind of like the momentum starts going with Canelo already before the fight starts. You know, it ain't a good look. However, I will add this, though. From the other perspective, it's kind of like, well, if Canelo's going to get that shit off on him and then he's about to lose the fight and really actually get styled on in the fight, then he'll look real stupid.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, you know, Plant can still... Maybe he wasn't, like, discouraged from this or whatever. He takes this as motivation. He's going to step in there and... be able to pull off the upset. No, I mean, who knows? Like, there's so many intangibles. That's what boxing's for, and it's a fight that a lot of that definitely built up his curiosity. Now, if people were kind of ho-hum about it at first, I mean, it's the fact that it's a Canelo fight and he's fighting another guy who's undefeated and, you know, has a belt and stuff like that. But it's gotten to the point where we get excited for it, and then Canelo kind of routes these guys, unless it's like, you know, Triple G, it seems, right? But there seemed to be some kind of intrigue with Plant. For the fact that, it, you know, his style, hate to say it, that maybe he's a white guy too with his style and, you know, the PBC and everything that, you know, with PBC and how he's really shut down his competition. He hasn't really been tested much as a pro himself. As he stepped up, he's, you know, impressively won each time. And I think people are like ready for Canelo to be tested again too. I think they're getting bored with the same type of routine with his fights where... Whereas the Callum Smith fight, where people were hoping Smith might be able to test him, and instead he got routed. Billy Joe Saunders, people were thinking he might be able to style him, and instead, you know, he got his face broken. I mean, he put up a good fight, but Canelo was in control the whole way, unless you listen to Chris Mannix. And then
nobody listens to Chris Mannix.
I'm just saying, you know. So people, I think, are, you know, thirsty to see Canelo be tested again, and they're not sure if Triple G would be able to be the person to do that again because of his age and how he's looked in subsequent fights. So Plant is probably the best option for that, you know, and he has the style that could give Canelo fits, or at least the old Canelo from years ago. They were talking about when he fought Austin Trout and Lara, because a lot of people still go back and hark on that. Well, he struggled with Lara. Oh, he struggled with Trout. Oh, look what Mayweather did to him. He's clearly not the same guy that he was back when he was, you know, barely 20, 21, 22 years old or whatever it was. You know, he's obviously matured since then, grown. You see him, he's a slick fighter himself now, a counter puncher and a really good one at that, and knows how to break down guys and systematically beat them up and just, you know, take their soul. So I don't know, man. It's a very intriguing fight. It's gonna be a good fight. I'm really looking forward to it. I don't, you know, we'll just see where it goes from here. We'll see if it gets postponed or whatever's gonna happen.
I think you bring up a couple good points, dude. I do think that Caleb Plant does have the kind of style that Canelo has had issues with in the past.
Yeah.
And that being the kind of style that is a natural counterpuncher, fast hands, good footwork, somebody who's able to kind of keep you at the end of a jab. Mm-hmm. That kind of style has historically not been a very good style for Canelo just in general, because he himself is a natural counter puncher. And even so, that's kind of, even if that's not really how he's sold, he's often kind of like, especially with the whole Mexican style bit. I know that that's Golovkin's thing, but it's kind of been carried over and applied to many Mexicans and whatnot. So the expectation is like, well, then Mexican fighters fight aggressively all of the time or something like that. But he's definitely more of a natural counterpuncher. And I think that because of that, or at least in part because of that, the other natural counterpunchers who maybe have size on him, a little bit of speed on him, and et cetera, they give him trouble. But like you said, also, he's learned and he's grown from other fights where he's shown, you know, real problems with that style. I thought that Callum Smith, because of his height and because of his jab, could probably give him a trouble. And that was not even remotely the case whatsoever. But he's also, Canelo has shown, like, for instance, in the Golovkin rematch, he's shown that he can come forward. He can fight more aggressively. He can kind of out fight the guy who was supposed to be coming forward and doing the out fighting. So I think that he has shown a couple more facets to his game than many people might give him credit for. And looking at him face to face with Caleb Plant, yeah, Caleb Plant's definitely got height on him, but it's not the kind of height where I'm looking at it going, like, oh, he ain't going to touch him.
Tall guy. He's not tall like Smith was. Or like Kovalev, yeah, or something like that, you know?
Not lanky like that. And yeah, he doesn't have the same kind of forceful jab as Kovalev, for instance.
Definitely not.
Although I will say, I'm not trying to caveat myself into a fucking corner here, but Kovalev did do well at times with a really strong jab, but Caleb Plant's not that kind of jabber. He's not going to like step in and like
jab Kovalev his face off. Kovalev knocked out dudes with jabs to the body. And
exactly. Yeah, he's a hard forceful jabber and
Kovalev is like a pressure boxer who goes in there and kind of beats you up while he was boxing you, while Plant is more of, like you said, a counterpuncher and a slickster, but a very good one at that. He knows how to stay in the pocket. He has excellent defense. He can counter well. He has fast hands, and he has natural skill. Like, I've seen some people almost try to compare him to James Toney. I'm not going to go that far with it. There's similarities there, but I mean, Tony is obviously levels above what Paul was. But
yeah,
you know,
I suppose in style a little bit, but not that much.
But Plant, I think again, people are just really trying to find a guy that's going to like give him fits, and they're kind of leaning back, thinking, well, Plant's going to be the guy to do it because of his style, like a lot of other opponents.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that you also, before you brought up a good point, that a lot of people seem like they're not bored, but they just want to see him challenged.
Yeah.
And obviously there's going to be limitations. He's not a very big guy in terms of height or mass, so there's going to be weight limitations as far as how high up he can go. Like, but
that's like, why people are already like coming with like, you know, scenarios of, hey, what if, I bet you if Canelo went to heavyweight, he could beat Trevor Bryan. Oh, Canelo can go to cruiser. Like they're talking like this.
Of course.
Yeah, I've heard people when Char was, whoever's WBA champion, it's always the weakest dude. So just insert any of those guys. Does it really matter? And they would mention, oh, Canelo would beat one of them. And he probably would. I'm sure Canelo would beat the shit out of Char. So what? Like,
yeah,
what is that going to prove? You know?
Well, and as we saw with Roy Jones, like, is it going to be worth messing around with your weight?
Exactly.
I don't know about that. I think that light heavyweight's probably the really upper limit, and they're going to be light heavyweights eventually, I would imagine. Like I don't know what's going on with Senior Beev, dude, Better Beev. I'm not entirely sure what's going on with Dmitry Bivol either. I know they've supposed to be fighting for like 7 years. But no, I don't know what's going on with them for real, but I feel like at their best, both of those guys could seriously give Bivol Canelo trouble.
Oh my God. I think Bivol has a style that would give Canelo fits because.
But they're so inactive and like, where are they? Where, what's going on?
Yeah. He's a very, very good boxer. He has that, you know, long, lanky style that knows like the European style too, that can like stay away and keep his distance. And he's tall, has a longer reach, very fluid in the ring, very well rounded. I mean, he has a style that would be a very, very difficult fight. That would be really interesting and difficult. Better Beef on his own, just an absolute monster himself who just has, you know, hammers for fists. And that's another one that Canelo would definitely be hard pressed to go against, because even though he'd be able to counter him and do things against him too, Better Bivoso is very crafty in there. Now he's not just a walking slugging, you know.
No, not at all.
Like what he did to Godzev. Is that my saying his name right again? Who he beat for the
Vostick.
Vostick, yeah.
Yeah.
He absolutely broke him down. You know, that was just like a dominating performance. He hasn't really capitalized it since then, but you know, that's where the challenges lie. Light heavyweight, and also too, you can't forget David Benavidez.
That's true. No, David Benavidez, I think he has the kind of range. Well, he's having a tough time keeping his career on track, it sounds like, overall. But nonetheless, he does have the kind of range and enough power. I think that could be worrisome for Canelo. But also, not to shortchange Caleb Plant, I do think that this is the kind of fight where we shouldn't be overlooking it. And we should be looking at it as, if Canelo wins this fight, that's a really good win. And he, you know, I mean, consolidates. It is a
big win. Like, Plant, like, I wasn't trying to change him earlier, but
for sure.
Plant is a very, very credible win. He's one of the best super middleweights in the world, one of the top young fighters in the world right now, who has a lot of momentum. And he's a very confident champion. Ever since he won the IBF title, he thinks he's the man of the division. And I'm sure and I know he's a little salty too of all the, like, you know, Canelo attention that gets around there, and he wants to prove himself the best. So this is his big opportunity. I mean, didn't it got off to a rocky start today with the press conference, but if anything, he's going into this fight motivated. This is the biggest fight of his career. If he pulls off Canelo, he knows where this brings him. He brings him to the very top of the world. And like any fighter that beats Canelo, like, that's the biggest fight you can win in boxing. You know what I mean? You just beat their top attraction out there. So, yeah. You know,
that's a big motivator, you know, or at least you would think that it is. It seems to me that after this scuffle between Canelo and Caleb Plant, that Canelo is kind of coming out of this thing a bit of the heel. You know, he's kind of playing the heel role. He's leaning into it, embracing it just a little bit, kind of going like, all right, man, you know, you're going to talk shit to me, I'm going to slap you up a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah.
Under most circumstances, he seems fairly cool-headed. He might talk some shit, but he doesn't really...
He's been getting a little salty ever since, you know. With Demetrius Andrade, but when they're in the press conference after the...
Get Billy the fuck out of here!
Yeah, get out of here, man. I'll beat you down right now. I'll beat your ass. He's like, fuck you. Yeah.
Yeah. Sure, was good.
You. Absolutely. He's starting to feel himself. You know?
Yeah, and you know what, dude? He probably should. He's on a bit of a roll. And so for Caleb Plant to stop that role would be huge for him. It would be huge for Caleb Plant's career too. So yeah, I mean, it's big news, and I get it, and it's fun. I'm not gonna lie, I got caught up in it too on Twitter. It's a whole bunch of arguing.
Like you said, we're starved for anything at this moment. You know what I mean? So this was a lot.
It's fun.
It was fun to see. When press conferences get a little heavy, it's always excitement, because usually they're boring. Nothing like, you know. Besides some trash talking, they're not the most exciting thing to be at. And so whenever something like this gets popping off, then it's a good thing. And luckily, like I said, hopefully this cut, for one, it's good that it's under his eye. So that that helps out. But let's just hope it wasn't too deep or too gnarly that, you know, something has to get postponed or whatever for it.
Yeah, man. Well, trying sweet hands gonna get some sweet stitches. We don't want that.
Yeah, and you know, don't wear sunglasses to a press conference anymore if you think you're gonna get physical.
Yeah, or take them off or something.
Something, man.
I don't know. Well, I mean, hopefully everything goes forward, because I want to see that fight. I know you want to see that fight.
Yeah, everybody absolutely. That's gonna be nice way to.
I don't know what today did, but I mean, it was. It probably
it got a lot more attention, man, because you know what?
Got some sales.
Trending all over Twitter. It's definitely gonna be all over the sport pages, all over the net, like it has been. And if people weren't even like aware that this fight was happening, like the casual fans are just, you know, things in general like that, they certainly are now.
Yeah, that might make. I don't watch ESPN like SportsCenter anymore, exactly. But that might make SportsCenter. I mean, that something like that, you know, or at least something of that magnitude. It'll probably make ESPN front page.
Oh, they're happening in boxing now. Everything, you know, there was a time years ago, and it was on YouTube up until a few years ago, up until a year or two ago, I guess, where they Don King, I don't know what this early 2000s, I forgot what fight he was promoting, but Don King was on Sports Center doing a countdown of the 10 craziest moments in boxing that like happened or whatever.
Yep.
And the way he was like, you know, just Don King mode with his flags and stuff like that.
Yep.
He's like, number 10, Marco Antonio Barrera swings at Eric Morales.
I'm almost positive I have that. In fact, yeah, I'm
really,
sure.
Really, really funny. And then he's like, he goes talking, vengeance can never be so. Da-da-da. And then he goes on again. Like, it's hilarious. Don just being Don.
The Don.
Yeah.
Don King, legend. Sometimes in not a good way. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, you know, it's probably going to get it a couple more views at the very least, but hopefully it goes through. Hopefully everything's good. Well, a little bit more genuinely than that press conference scuffle between Canelo and Caleb Plant, this weekend we got Anthony Joshua facing Oleksandr Usyk. Man, it's been every time we get a bigger fight, especially, you know, like in the midst of the pandemic, every time we get a bigger fight, it's like cause for celebration. Like I said, we're starved, dude. We're pretty thirsty. So we're here and we have the consensus best cruiserweight and a damn good fighter going up to heavyweight to face Anthony Joshua, who himself is a pretty, pretty fucking good fighter and a very popular fighter.
You know, and this fight is happening because Fury and Joshua fell apart. Of course it would. But at least this, if this is the consolation prize, I mean, this is a hell of a, you know, this is a hell
you
of a
big stiff prize. Idiot.
Yeah. Usyk is like, he moved up to heavyweight recently. Like you mentioned, he was the undisputed cruiserweight king and generally looked upon by most people as probably the best cruiserweight since Holyfield. Or close to it. I mean, there might be a couple of guys in the, you know, that I can name drop in the running for that. But Usyk, for what he did and how he cleaned out the division and the guys that he beat in a very, very deep division during the time that he was there, was absolutely phenomenal. And he did it with such style, such grace. Like, he just, you know, he swept up at the Super Six. The only time he really struggled in a fight was in the semifinals against Brady's. Which, well, you know, that dude is an absolute monster in himself. And Usyk was still one that wasn't like it was a fight that you thought he lost. I mean, it was a close fight, but it was just a fight that he was touched up in a lot. And then in the finals of the tournament, he put on an absolute masterclass, man, against, Gassiev. Gassiev.
Murat Gassiev.
Yeah, Gassiev. And, you know, for him to be able to do that, like, that's completely cleaning out the division. That is a sweep up what Canelo's trying to do as super middleweight type deal. Like, it doesn't happen often, especially in this era with so many titles and everything like that. That's why the Muhammad Ali tournament is such a good thing, whenever it doesn't have issues. Anyways,
yeah. When they can get it to work, dude. When they can get tournaments to work, they're awesome.
You know, so with that being said, Usyk was able to clean out the cruiserweight division. And he has such a unique style, at least when he did at cruiserweight, where, you know, nimble on the feet, just fast hands, fluid combinations. He's trained by Lomachenko's dad. You know, they all come from the same camp, you know, Olympic gold medalist, absolutely stellar amateur career. Almost like the complete package, you know what I mean? But here's the catch, though, is that since he's moved up to heavyweight, he hasn't looked as spectacular. You know, in the two fights that he's had over here, one against a very shock-worn Chaz Witherspoon and the other against always a tough Derek Chisora, you know, he didn't look 100%. He didn't look like the Usyk at cruiserweight. You know, the fluidness, the movement, and everything like that, it just seemed kind of a little bit more worn down and slowed down a little bit. And people were just like, oh, he's just getting adjusted, or is this that, you know, whatever it may be. But I don't, you know, it's the fact that he's actually jumping into this fight with Joshua so quickly, I was almost a little surprised with, but you know, I'm all for it. It's a very, very intriguing fight, but I'm not sure if he's still the same guy he was at cruiserweight.
I think that there are legitimate questions as to there's legitimate skepticism as to whether or not he would be, not just based on the Chisora fight, which, I mean, if you're throwing asterisks at that fight, you're probably looking at it and thinking, okay, well, that's Derek Chisora potentially overperforming. He obviously fought a very good fight and a good strategy for that fight. And I mean, he's pretty spotty. You kind of don't really know which.
You don't know which one's showing up. He's just was. Yeah.
He also had almost 40 pounds on Usyk too, which whatever, it was fair. It's at heavyweight. I'm not saying it's unfair, but that also goes to your point, that whether or not the
Usyk's not a big heavyweight.
He's not a very big heavyweight, and whether or not he's actually carrying the weight and stuff like that, the way that we would expect him to or want him to going into a fight against a really big heavyweight like Anthony Joshua, there's a lot of potential there for Usyk, who can be hit. He's very skilled, and he's not going to get hit nearly as much as I think a lot of other heavyweights.
Definitely,
and
definitely not.
He's got the kind of style where I think he takes like the mustard off of shots pretty well, rolls with them very well. But you don't really need to get hit that solid by a guy weighing 240, 250, 255 in that size.
And a guy who throws like Joshua. Like Joshua throws everything pinpoint, very straight, well compact, and they all got a lot of oomph on him.
Yeah, he has good technique overall, and if he lands hard, I mean, that uppercut video notwithstanding, I think he was just fucking around with that. But regardless, it probably not even good to fuck around and with the techniques though. But regardless, the other part of that is that historically, even the best cruiserweight going up at heavyweight has problems, except for like two people. Like obviously Evander Holyfield is the notable example of consolidating the cruiserweight title and winning the cruiserweight title in absolutely hellhole fight against Dwight Muhammad Cowie in the first fight, and having the kind of coming of age fight in that kind of fight is like, holy shit, that's a trial by fire. That's
That was still from a division that wasn't like that, still had no respect.
It was new. Yeah.
Yeah, it was still relatively new, still the bastard division of boxing at the time. No one, Cowie was probably its most recognizable champion up until that point. And that was the fight that that was the first time that like the cruiserweight division got actual attention. Was that fight.
Good attention.
Good attention because of how fucking good it was. It was an incredible, incredible fight. Like one of the best overall best title fights ever, regardless of division. It doesn't even, but that's the gold standard of cruiserweight right there. And Holyfield completely cleaned it out quickly. He didn't waste any time. He jumped from him to, to another rematch with Cowie, in between knocking out Ozzy Ocasio, a former champion, Ricky Parkey, Carlos De Leon, who was the longstanding champion, who, I think he won like three times or so. Yeah, three-time champion. And so, once he wiped it out, though, there was no need to stay in cruiserweight. What else are you going to do at that division? And once he moved back up to heavyweight, cruiserweight went back to being moribund again, and no one cared about it because they lost their star attraction.
Right, and there's only been, there's been so many examples of fighters. I remember David Haye was considered obviously a very good cruiserweight. He was a very good cruiserweight. Moved up to heavyweight, obviously had good success, but in my opinion, a very overrated tenure at heavyweight. Juan Carlos Gomez, another guy who was not often on American TV. So he was kind of one of those guys you'd see in the ring and hear about. And he held a cruiserweight title. He held a cruiserweight title for fucking ever, it seemed. And then he went up to heavyweight and remember he got smashed by Yonky Diaz? He got rabbit punched to fucking hell. That was, it was kind of awful. But still, after that,
he was featured on HBO too, on one of those he was called a young heavyweight. Night of the, he was like, remember when the first night of the young heavyweights was Tua, obviously, and
And at the time, Darryl he was Wilson probably 38.
Yeah, exactly. And this one was definitely not of the same caliber of guys, because this card was Juan Carlos Gomez, who was a good fighter, but just obviously not.
Yeah, he was a good fighter.
Juan Carlos Gomez against Sunil Sam, which is a fight that would definitely be on like the Zone or something today.
I remember that. And wasn't Dominic Gwynn on that?
Yeah, Dominic Gwynn against Duncan Dakuari.
That's right. I remember and that. And
the main event was Joe Macy knocking the hell out of Deverell Williamson.
Deverell Williamson. Yeah. I remember that. Yep. Damn, I remember that. Yeah, and Deverell Williamson himself was like 36.
Yeah. It was just...
And Joe Messi was like 33. They need to chill with this young
heavyweight. So, anyways, that was... like, the cruiserweight division in general, it, like, when it was first founded in 1980, no one knew what to make of it, right? Like, people were just like, what the hell is this? There's a division now between 175 and 200 pounds. And we got to deal with something. It's kind of like how people look at Bridgeweight today. Thing is, no one wants to go to Bridgeweight. At least there was fighters willing that couldn't win a heavyweight title or was like a washed up light heavyweight. That was like, you know what? I'll give Cruiserweight a shot because it seemed like an easy belt. So you had guys from the light heavyweight division, like Victor Galindez, Jesse Burnett, Yaki Lopez.
Yeah, guys who didn't want to make 175 anymore, basically.
And they were older at that point, and they knew that, you know, when Michael Spinks at the helm and Matthew San Muhammad and others, they weren't going to, you know, Dwight Muhammad Cowie, chances are they weren't going to be able to win a title anymore. That time was over. So they move up to cruiserweight because it seemed like an easy bet. Same thing with, like, heavyweights that would try to move down because it seemed like maybe, like, an easy chance to win a belt. He had a guy like Randy Stevens, who was kind of like a fringe contender, a gatekeeper, a very small heavyweight. He moved down the cruiserweight. Ozzy Ocasio, another one. He was a guy who twice upset Jimmy Young, you know, a middling heavyweight, challenged Larry Holmes for the belt, but undersized himself. After he got whooped by Michael Doakes, he moved down the cruiserweight. There was only a few guys who were like natural cruiserweights who just came up. I mean, well, no, they were like light heavyweights to begin with as well. The first two guys who fought for the title were former light heavyweights who had moved up, Mati Parlov and Marvin Camel. And of course, to start out the division with a bang, the first fight was a draw. So, you know, for a vacant title in the first fight's a draw. Camel ends up becoming the first champion of the division, loses it to Carlos De Leon. And then that's what people were just like, you know, this division sucks. Leon Spinks was supposed to bring some spark into it. He moved down and did absolutely, you know, Leon was in the midst of being Leon, like really neon Leon during the 80s. So he completely just like blew it. And guys like D. Leon and later Dwight Cowie and others just, you know, took turns beating the hell out of him. And no one really just like was able to make a star of themselves because no one cared about it. No one was getting, well, if they were going to be televised, yeah, it was going to be like the opening of a card. Half the time these fights were like non-televised. And if you were going to become a champion, it was only be for a cup of coffee so you can try to move up and try to do something at heavyweight.
It had a few things going against it. One, it was at a time where, like, you know, the IBF was just emerging. So it was kind of like, you know, who knows how legitimate that belt is at all. Exactly. And then on top of that, the other belts were being passed between these other fighters so freely that nobody really made much of it. I think, you know, it was like there wasn't a reigning champion to the point where I think that would have possibly given it more respect. Maybe not. I don't know. But the whole theme is that almost none of these guys were successfully able to move up to heavyweight you know, win more than a few fights or have some success. And the whole point being that, what, 18, 19 fights in, Oleksandr Usyk, who had a pretty long amateur career, have to look over here, he's 34. All right, so he's not old, but he's not young. But he had a long amateur career. He's moving up to heavyweight to face a guy much, much bigger. I mean, the odds are and probably should be stacked against him here, especially considering he's going at Anthony Joshua at the Tottenham Hotspur Stadium, which is, I mean, it's going to be like, there's going to be like four Usyk fans in that entire crowd, and God help them. But, you know, the odds are stacked against him for a number of different reasons.
Absolutely. And it should be noted, you know, Holyfield was obviously the gold standard when it comes to moving up to heavyweight and dominating and becoming heavyweight champion. Keep this in mind. The heavyweights that Holyfield were fighting, with the exception of George Foreman and maybe, you know, one or two others, like Lennox Lewis later on and so, were not the size of the guys that Usyk is going up to fight now. That's a different ballgame. Not to say they're as talented. The 90s, you know, I've always going to hold near and dear to my heart, especially for talented fighters and all that. But I'm just saying size-wise, Buster Douglas is not the same size as Anthony Joshua. Buster Douglas was not a small guy himself, but he's just, you know, there's a noticeable difference there. Mike Tyson, same thing. Like, guys like that, like, you know.
So if we're kind of like flipping the to the other side here now,
okay.
So we know about cruiserweights and the kind of lack of success for most cruiserweights going up to heavyweight, especially facing a much bigger heavyweight, a much more powerful heavyweight. But then flipping it back to Anthony Joshua, you know, it almost feels like he has more than one loss. I mean, I don't want to trash the guy because he is a very good fighter. It seems crazy to me that he was an Olympian almost 10 years ago in 2012. Like, I mean, that's just, I don't know. So much time has gone by. He started out a handful of years ago, very busy. And in the last few years has slowed down quite a bit.
Yes. Yeah. Cause he's become a big brand now. And now he's just a brand.
Right.
Yeah.
And so I think that kind of like, I don't want to overanalyze it and over psychoanalyze it, but it does seem to me like a lot of that kind of gets to him a bit, like he's not ready for it, and especially like he wasn't real ready for the loss.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, maybe I'm reading too much into it, but he doesn't really strike me as somebody who handles the fame super well. And the only way for him to handle it is to basically just be quiet and just kind of like, you know, like focus and not really do anything. And that's fine, I guess, if that's what he needs to do to keep himself together, and that's what he needs to do. And I'm not going to slag him for it, but he does seem a little bit more fragile to me than, like, for instance, Oleksandr Usyk, who seems like maybe perhaps a bit of a lunatic and maybe a little bit insane, but he seems like he's having fun.
That photo bomb of Aram, video bomb, whatever.
yeah.
The video, I'm coming for you.
Well, he's clearly like, he knows what time it is, dude. Like, he knows that he's on. He knows that I think that he understood pretty quickly the I am very feel thing, that like it became a meme. And then he was like, oh, well, then I'm just going to go ahead and start saying this shit. Kind of like how Golovkin started with the, you know, big drama show type shit. Yeah, like, you know, really hammering home the whatever. And anyway, he seems to get it in that regard, and he seems like he's kind of just having fun. Not that he doesn't take it serious, but I don't really see Anthony Joshua doing that kind of stuff. And absolutely, like I said,
no, he's definitely,
if that's what he needs to do, like holding it together, to like, he doesn't fuck around, doesn't joke around, that's whatever, you know. But it seems like a little bit more fragile, I guess. Like the ecosphere around him, is he can't be upset, and if it is, then that's a problem.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe I'm wrong, I don't know.
No, I get that sense from you. It's the type of thing that, like, he's very in tune of his surroundings, who he keeps around him, what he does, like, kind of careful, and when he does in public, what he's out there doing stuff, like, he doesn't try to, everything is kind of well planned to make sure he doesn't tarnish his image. But I mean, some things have actually popped out from there. That little scandal with Amir Khan claiming that he slept with his wife, and I think Eddie Chambers coming out saying he said some shit to him one time, and some other stuff. But like, for the most part, Joshua makes sure, and his people around him make sure, that his image and his brand, for that matter, are always well, because of everything that he has going for him. The fact that he's the champion, the standing that he has with his fans and everywhere else, the major sponsorships that he has going for him. Like, this is, you know, Joshua's like a global brand right now. Like, he's huge. He's him and Canelo are like the two big ones in boxing. And, you know, I was ringside at MSG. I got a chance. I was working the first Joshua Ruiz fight at MSG. And that crowd that night was just like amazing, dude. Like, the way it was packed out. I mean, many people were in there. Everyone was wilding out for all the Brits and everything like that, you know, for Joshua's arrival. And you just felt that, like, the hairs on your neck were packing up when he, like, walked out to the ring, and the place just absolutely exploded. because you felt you were, you know, no one knew what was going to happen that night. Like, what ended up happening just made it 10 times even better, because that was the most incredible experience to witness. But just to see Joshua in itself, though, and the type of crowd that he commands, and this was his first fight in America, not even, you know, I can't even imagine how it is in a stadium in the UK, but like, just, you know, at MSG, packed to the hilts, and people just losing it, and you feel that energy, you know what I mean? That energy that certain people have, that just, you know, you're involved in something big. Like, this is not just another title fight. That was like the craziest feeling I ever felt. And I've felt a lot of, like, you know, I've worked some title fights at MSG. I've worked heavyweight title fights at MSG. And there was something about that night and that aura, especially after it went down, man. It can't be explained.
Well, our buddy Corey Erdman for Boxing Scene wrote an article about Anthony Joshua's appeal and his popularity and how big of a draw he is, that I would recommend people read. But I think that it's kind of understated, especially to a lot of American fans who don't quite understand. I mean, I don't want to go too far out into left field or take the conversation elsewhere for too long here, but over the last several years, the narrative has been, and I'm not necessarily saying it's incorrect per se, but the narrative from promoters, from network people, etc., has been, Livegate doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. Nobody cares about Livegate. Nobody's counting the tickets. Nobody gives a shit. What they care about is, they care about ratings. They care about subscriptions. They care about sponsorships. And again, I'm not saying that that's not true. You know, DAZN subscriptions is the name of the game. Mm-hmm. Showtime subscriptions, name of the game. Fox, you know, and the sponsors that they're able to pull in through good ratings with their shows, you know, the name of the game, etc. That's, I get it. All of those things equal money. But at the same time, when you're pulling in tens of thousands of people every time you fight, mm-hmm. that's not something that you can like just ignore. That's not like, we don't really care about that $43 million gate. Holy shit. Really, you know, that's not something that happens very often. But regardless, point being, it's not as irrelevant as the narrative has kind of played it down. But I think because of the way that narrative has been pushed by so many American promoters, the idea that somebody in, like, this happened, you and I know, this happened all through the 90s and the 2000s, for instance, like in Germany, perfect example. Fucking Darius Mikulchevsky, Sven Otke. Sven Otke is probably the greatest example, because that dude's style sucked and everybody knew it. Nobody gave a shit. Dude was drawing in like 60,000 people every huge single amount. Time he
Henry
fought,
Master,
man.
You just mentioned Henry right. Master. Yep.
Yeah, these dudes
his
often
fights
were
would
not
sell out before the opponent was even announced, and he was boring as shit.
Yeah, they were not. These were not.
Mikulchevsky was fun to watch, but yeah.
Yeah, Mikulchevsky was pretty aggressive, hard hitting.
Yeah, exactly. The point, but those guys, huge. Absolutely.
Europe, just absolutely massive superstars. Yep. Sven Otke was on like a whole bunch of different reality shows, or at least a couple of different reality shows when reality TV started mm-hmm. breaking, and he was either just barely retired or before he retired. Point being, you know, these guys were superstars, and women too. Actually, Cecilia Brekus was selling fucking Blockbuster in Germany and Sweden for a bit.
Regina Helmich.
Yep. Dude, there were Susie Kentikian was.
Oh, I remember.
I don't know if she's still. I don't think she's active, but yeah, she was very popular in Germany. Yeah, and so point being, these people were superstars. They made a shitload of money, even if they were shortchanged in the sense that they were probably not getting into the International Boxing Hall of Fame and were not thought very highly of by most American writers or journalists or whatever. But they sold a shitload of tickets. And so, I mean, what does that mean toward being TBE or making money in the US? Nothing, I guess. But just the point being that moving tickets like that can't be overlooked. And Anthony Joshua is selling fucking gangbusters, bro.
Yeah, man. He's huge. Absolutely huge. And I don't know, man. If you would lose to Usyk today, that would, even though a lot of people wouldn't consider that an upset, and I'm not sure if I would either for that matter, considering how great, like, you know, how good of a fighter Usyk is and his credentials, and I know he could pull it off because he's just that good of a fighter, and Joshua, you know, could get pieced up. Who knows? But I'm just saying, if he were to lose, that would throw a huge, like, that would throw the division upside down again. There's so many scenarios of where to go with that and so many different fights and all. Kind of like when Ruiz upset Joshua the first time. And everyone was just kind of like, holy shit, what are we going to, you know, what's going on and what can you do and all that. And, like, there was, it creates excitement. Creates a lot of excitement, a lot of big things. And with this fight coming up, hopefully I say that, we finally finished the trilogy of Wilder and Fury in October. And then, you know, we'll see what happens after that.
Well, our king is still here. Yes. So the way that it looked like it was going to be, as a lot of people know, but just in case anybody was, like, you know, looking for a brief recap, when Tyson Fury had kind of taken his vacation, when he was having his issues and more or less retired or was sitting out, it seemed like Anthony Joshua versus Deontay Wilder was the fight that everybody wanted to see. It was two hard-hitting and, at the time, unbeaten heavyweights that it was kind of had collision course, kind of, you know, Zarate versus Zamora kind of written all over it type of shit. You know, like, just high knockout percentage versus high knockout percentage. Let's fucking go type of shit. And that was all derailed by Andy Ruiz Jr., you know, at that point. But then, of course, Tyson Fury coming back and kind of reclaiming his portion of the throne, or the throne, however you want to look at it, by absolutely gobsmacking Deontay Wilder. So now we have to settle that, man. I hope that shit is settled. And then whoever wins between Usyk and Anthony Joshua has to fight whoever wins that fight, really. I mean, that's how it's got to be. If there's a God, that's how it's got to be.
I'll say this, man. Honestly, like, if Lewis and Tyson could get together, if Holyfield and Lewis can get together, they can make this fight, all right? Like,
those fights were always, like, impossible at the time. Impossible. You know, that can't happen.
Absolutely impossible. I think the late, great Jay Larkin actually said palm trees. He made a comment about, I forgot what quote it was, but it was a really funny quote about something growing in palm trees in Tel Aviv before Tyson Lewis would happen. He made some kind of, it was a funny comment that I can't remember exactly what it was, but he made a comment basically saying there's no chance in hell it's ever going to happen.
And then Jay Larkin, the head of Showtime at the time, had Tyson on lockdown.
Absolutely.
And Lewis was with HBO pretty firmly. And so they were,
Kerry Davis probably in charge.
I think
that fight happened. I think so. Yeah. Cause it was around 2002 to 2003. So I think so.
Yeah. So that fight was considered impossible. I mean, they made that fight happen. Remember they had the split announcers, they had the split announcing team or the commentating team. I mean, the entire thing was like, it was kind of ridiculous, but now Showtime's commentating team is that size on its own.
I forgot that they had Jimmy Lennon and Michael Buffer announcing.
You remember that?
Like, holy shit, man, that was wild.
Yeah, it was kind of stupid, but whatever. No, it was the fact that they can make that, they should be able to kind of, you know, make something happen. Let's hope. But what do you think is going to happen? What do you think is happening this weekend?
I don't know, man. There's so many scenarios you can go by in this fight. There really is. It just goes, like, you know, I could see Usyk just being able to be too fast on his feet that, like, he's able to get in and out enough to be able to outbox Joshua and just be too fast for him, get in, flurry, get out, whatever it needs to be, angle him and stuff like that. Not to say Joshua's this flat-footed guy who can't get off when he's doing that either, but I mean, I just think he might be just too nimble for him, too quick-footed. At the same time, I think Joshua could be too big for him and too long for him that he's able to neutralize him to a degree with his jab and, I guess, some right hands and stuff like that, and win probably an unexcited decision, like a fight that, you know, he wins somewhat for whatever it may be, but I don't know. Yeah, it just goes so many ways here, man. So I can't really go defending it. One minute I'm thinking Usyk has a chance. The next minute I'm thinking Joshua might just take it by decision. But put a gun to my head right now, I think Joshua might eke out a close decision. But I think Usyk has a hell of a chance.
I think that about sums up how I feel. Yeah. I think Joshua probably is going to take a decision. Just a gut feeling, I guess. I like Oleksandr Usyk. I think he's funny. I think that he's a good character, and he's a very good fighter, very accomplished amateur, very accomplished pro too. What he did at cruiserweight was highly respectable, and the fighters that he took care of, it was a very good cruiserweight division that he ran through. So already I think that his accomplishments as a professional are impressive. But I mean, I guess if you look at the kind of training angle too, you brought up Papachenko, Vasily Lomachenko's dad, who's, Oleksandr Usyk's in that same camp. And he is, I don't know that you could say he's like a genius or a training genius or savant or anything like that, but he's obviously
that word gets, that label gets thrown around a lot to trainers, especially
it when does.
They have total success.
It does. And I think that it's kind of like, well, like let him grow a stable and have success with a whole bunch of fighters before you say something like that. But clearly
when Virgil Hunter was Eddie Futch.
Right. And I mean, I think that he's clearly shown a propensity for coming up with a good game plan at the very least, or understanding what he's seeing in the ring, which is good. Rob McCracken, I don't really know that much about apart from his work with Anthony Joshua and Carl Froch, or was it Carl Froch or was it Carl Frampton? Rob McCracken, one of the Carls.
Oh, Rob McCracken, I think, trained Carl Froch.
It was Carl Froch. That's right. And also, Carl Froch was kind of another guy who had a lot of amateur experience, and it's kind of tough to say how much Rob McCracken like formed his style or anything like that. I'm saying I honestly don't know. I'm not saying Rob McCracken's a bad trainer, but whatever happens in the fight, I'm not entirely sure is going to come from like the training part of it. It's going to come from somebody showing they have the little extra, somebody showing they have it a little bit more, or want it a bit more. And I just have the feeling that Anthony Joshua is kind of in a position where he's going to need to lash out and show something. We'll see.
Oh, absolutely. He knows that too. I mean, and so does Usyk. I mean, they both know that this is, if Usyk loses this one, it's going to be tough for him. It's not going to be easy enough for him to just be able to bounce back and get right back into a title fight that quickly. Like, he's going to have to fight other contenders, maybe like have a rematch with Chisora or fight Dillian White or whoever. You know, there's lots of guys out there in Eddie Hearn's land or whatever. So Joshua, if he wins this fight, he can, first off, he gets the boogeyman of the division now that people are trying to, that Colin Usyk, out of the way, right? And if he wins that convincingly, that would probably like take some naysayers that still think less of him after he lost to Ruiz or just in general, and make me make some convincing out of him. And then from there, all systems are a go where people are going to demand, okay, he needs to fight the winner of Fury and Wilder. Like, this needs to happen. Yeah. And they'll even after that fight, if once that happens and if Fury wins, then they hopefully be able to pick up negotiations right where they left off last time or whatever, whatever happened.
I think
because it looks like it was just about ready to done until Wilder won that case where they was forced to get the third fight. So
yeah, that was for a few days there. That was some funny Twitter legal drama. Yeah. Taking us back to whatever it was, 2002, when Lennox Lewis was taking King and everybody else to court and shit. And man, that was like just a massive fiascos all around. But no, there's too much going on in the division apart from Anthony Joshua for him to deny the winner of that fight, assuming the winner of that fight is a clear winner. And I mean, I think a lot of people would probably assume that it's going to be Tyson Fury. I would say that that's probably the correct assumption at this point, but we could be surprised, but either way, that fight has got to happen.
You don't think the bench pressing videos haven't convinced you, bro?
No. Oh, poor guy. I mean,
I'll say this for him. His jab looks better. He's moving around a little bit better. Yeah.
Yes. Like technique wise, when he's actually doing, yes. When it seems as though he's worked on his technique, and that's good. That's a good thing. But
keep the body.
I would don't upload bench pressing videos anymore with your feet off the ground, flailing wildly. Bro, what are
you doing? I'm not even a lifter like that. I can see that's the worst technique ever.
He's gonna hurt himself.
You got a fight coming up. You're about to injure yourself. What are you doing?
He's gonna hurt himself.
Yeah.
Don't lift like that. I'm not, look at me. I'm not giving anybody lifting advice, but for crying out loud, don't lift that way. Yeah, he's gonna hurt himself. So
like a pectoral muscle or whatever would be on brand for boxing too. It just would be
I think his best hope at this point is that he's clueless enough one way or another that the loss didn't affect him in that way, because he's just off in space and whatever, doing his fucking thing. And so he just comes into this blank slate, whatever, but it doesn't look that way, man. It sure didn't look that way after the knockout either. When he was uploading videos to Instagram, those were just like, I cringed so hard. I just crawled up into a shell like a snail, like, ugh. So bad. So awful. Anyway, I don't know what's going to happen in that fight. I would imagine it's going to be Tyson Fury, but either way, whoever wins, they need to take on Anthony Joshua just for the sake of balance in the universe.
Absolutely. And if Usyk wins, then same thing. But I have a feeling if Usyk wins, first thing they're going to do is have an immediate rematch with Joshua.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. That's just kind of the nature of how shit happens, you know. But whatever. I mean, it's what else is going on? Oh yeah, Oakley is fighting on that, and Callum Smith are also fighting on that card.
Yeah, it's a good card. I mean,
they're not fighting big names or anything by any means, but they're at least fighting, kind of rounding out, like, oh, Campbell Hatton. All right, we're gonna get to see Ricky Hatton's son, see if he can get to 4-0. Did you see his last fight, Campbell Hatton's last fight?
Nah, I didn't. I've caught highlights of him already, man. And poor kid is just being fed to the wall. Like, he's just...
Yeah, he had a real rough time in his last fight.
Yeah, he's getting, like... It's the fact that he's a name, that he's Ricky Hatton's kid, so he's being shoved on television when he's clearly not ready for it.
Yeah. Yeah, he needs to be developing. That's what sucks about a lot of those kind of, like, legacy fighters is... They could use that off.
Especially if your kid is like, especially if your dad is a big, big, big name. Yeah. Like, we practically watched Chavez Jr. grow up in front of us because of, like, you know, who his dad was. And Aaron force fed him to be like forced on every card, and you see him emaciated.
And he's like a goofball too. Ricky's like a goofball. So he's like embarrassing dad all of the time. So poor kid. Poor kid. No, it doesn't look to be a super deep card. I like Oakley. He's a good fighter. But apart from that, it doesn't really look to be that deep of a card. The main event is where it's at, of course. Yeah. But in any case, I hope it's a good fight. I hope we wind up with a conclusive ending. That's really the most important thing. But
I think we will. For some reason, I have a feeling there won't be a lot. I hope that there's not going to be crazy controversy for it.
But they need to put up that Riddick Bowe, Jorge Luis Gonzalez plexiglass at the weigh-in, because I don't need any Canelo plant incidents. We need this fight to happen.
Oh, they don't seem like the type of guys that go swinging on each other, though, do they?
Nah, not really. Nah.
Like, I know that someone shoved Usyk one time. I don't know if it was Chisora or whoever it was, but Usyk didn't even like respond back. He just kind of looked at them and did that, you know, that creepy smile and like pointed at them or something like that. But he didn't like try to retaliate, you know.
He's so weird, dude. The guys, he'll be okay. Whatever happens, he's going to go off into the woods and kill something. He'll be all right.
Either that or you're going to find him, you know, breakdancing on the beach again.
AJ. Yeah, this guy's a...
Well, you know what? There was that photo that emerged a few years back. I think you remember it, right? Where Usyk was in the audience, almost staring AJ down in the end of his cup or something. And he's just staring ahead, and AJ was like cheering, you know, after a fight. So,
like he's licking his chops or something.
Exactly. Just studying him already. And we've come full circle.
Well, I guess we're going to see if that bears any truth whatsoever. But, you know.
You know, he became number one contender because he was WBO cruiserweight champ, right? Don't they have that weird rule? If you move up a division, you automatically become number one contender.
Let me look real quick. I'm not sure. Because I know, yeah, because actually, look, too.
That's what Stevenson's doing against Herring.
Well, and also the fight against Derek Chisora. And I'm not in any way promoting these kind of like medium belts or whatever, but it was for the WBO Intercontinental Heavyweight title. And as we, most of us know, some of those little fringe belts or whatever are tied to the other larger organizations, so that if you win that belt, you automatically are ranked X, Y, or Z in the larger organization. So I don't even remember, because I try not to keep track of all the mandatory shit, but my guess was that fighting Chisora and that belt was then for a, like, I don't know, top five slot in the WBO or some shit. So whatever it was for, he's getting the, and yeah, you were right, because there was some sort of mandatory or some sort of date enforced. But yeah, that's why it's happening. At the very least, I hope that we get to see Usyk catch him with some big shots and see some testing.
I mean, I think Usyk's definitely going to land some punches on him. I mean, they're definitely going to, I think they'll feel each other out the first couple of rounds, try to gauge, see what the other one's working with a little bit. But then once they start warming up and feeling comfortable, that's when the hands will start going.
That's really all, is I don't want to see either guy playing it safe or anything like that. I get it. I want to see a good fight. I want to see somebody test.
From what I've watched most of his fights, he's the type of guy that gets going as each round goes on. Like, he gets better as the rounds go on. Like, you know, he's from the beginning, he starts out a little bit, and then as he gets warmed up, starts feeling himself through, that's when he really starts opening up, because he found the, you know, figured out. It's like he's almost computing in his head, just trying to figure, you know, fainting here, doing this, seeing what you bite, what works, what doesn't work here, this, blah, blah, blah. And then he starts gathering a system, computes it, and then he goes to work.
Totally. He's kind of does that Matrix shit that everybody's always going on about.
Lomachenko.
He's downloading the data.
Let me download the data. This stupid.
Let's just hope he's not plugged into. Yeah, it'd be bad. Download data that way.
Yeah.
No, let's hope it's a good fight. I think it probably will be, though, but we'll have to see. And we'll also have to see whether or not this is kind of a last hurrah for DAZN, because they seem like they're very quickly going downhill. They also sound like they're very seriously considering, what was it, raising subscription fees and doing pay-per-views?
Really?
So, yeah, something like that. So we'll have to see what this means for them and how exciting this is for them. But in the meanwhile, anyway, dude, I know it was a little awkward doing the video podcast today. It was the first time we'd done it, but it was pretty fun, right? Wasn't too bad.
It was a blast. Yeah, absolutely. No, glad I got a fresh lineup before I got, you know, my face on camera.
Me too. Look at that. Thank goodness. Now it was a lot of fun. I appreciate you doing it with me, and everybody who listened in, you're missing out, I guess, because you didn't watch the video.
Absolutely.
No, but in the meanwhile, if you are on social media, like Twitter, for instance, go ahead and go to Twitter, follow my buddy Aris Peanut, Punch Zone Aris. Follow me, Patrick Connor, at Patrick M. Connor. But also, if you would go to the Knuckles and Gloves YouTube page and subscribe, that would be helpful, of course. And if whatever you listen to the podcast, if you're listening and subscribe that way, that's also helpful. Give us a rating, all that stuff. And yeah, man, Aris, we'll talk soon, bro.
Always a pleasure, my man.
All right, take it easy, everybody.